I think we should be very careful about artificial intelligence. If I would guess at what our biggest existential threat is,
seconds is a revolutionary moment.
Bill,
what's the creature in the rocket cylinder, Robot Bill? I can give you no authoritative information either to their nature, their origin, or their purposes here on Earth.
Welcome to the Creative Futurism Podcast, bringing together the worlds of business, technology, and creativity. This is Kevin J. Anderson.
And this is John Best. You'll look at the world and the future in a whole new way. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Creative Futurism. My name is John Best.
And I'm Kevin J. Anderson.
And we're here to talk about cool stuff, about the world, the future, business, weapons, I guess, in our past episodes. Pretty much anything's game, right?
Creativity.
Creativity, the future, that's the name. And who do we got today? I know we've got something exciting going on here.
Well, most of you people, I assume, know how to read. And I'm a writer, so I like people who read. But you never thought that the technology of reading a book was going to completely dramatically change in the entire world that we live in. We're always used to picking up a paperback and flipping the pages. But something in about 2007,
seven-ish, yeah,
when the first Kindle came out. And it sort of changed everything. And people started reading on electronic readers. And there are, you might have heard of Kindles or iPads, but they're not the only game in town. And in fact, there are several. There's the Barnes & Noble Nook, and there is the Kobo, which is done by Rakuten. It's a company in mainly based in Canada. And the guest that we have today is the director of self-publishing and chief of author relations for Kobo. In fact, I have a Kindle, I have an iPad, but the one that I actually read my books on is my Kobo. I just kind of like the interface and I enjoy it.
Nice.
Mark Leslie of Fave, who's been a friend of mine for quite a while, and he's also a really interesting guy with a lot of up-to-date stuff. He helped develop the Kobo Writing Life self-publishing platform, and he's an expert on ebook publishing, the ebook industry in general, as well as international publishing. He's also the president of the Canadian Booksellers Association. And Mark, welcome to our podcast.
I'm delighted to be here, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, he thought I was going to keep reading paragraphs of his bio.
But I was expecting another half hour, but it's all good.
We've got lots of stuff to talk about, and I think our audience is sort of a general audience, people that have probably their own Kindle or Kobo and read ebooks and things. But maybe from the outside, they don't quite understand the absolute Hurricane Katrina or watershed that's happened in the publishing industry since ebooks have appeared.
And by ebooks, you mean the ebook itself in terms of the actual book, or do you mean the self-publishing format, or both?
Well, that's, I think, both of the projects, and I can certainly talk about it, but we've got Mark as a guest.
So yeah, that's what I'm trying to understand.
I'm going to turn Mark loose and tell us about the changes in the industry, because we authors who did all this thing felt like we had invested greatly in, like, Blockbuster video stores, and suddenly it all vanished under us.
You mean like those guys at Borders? Because that didn't go well for them either.
No, it didn't go well. I mean, so the funny thing about, when you think about digital reading and ebooks, it wasn't really popular until maybe it was the fall of 2006. The Sony PSR 500 came out. That was the first really good ebook reader. The Kindle followed that the following year. And ironically, digital books or ebooks were roughly 40 years old by the time they really took off. So you can truly say that life does begin at 40.
Did you say 40 years?
What's
that? 40 years old. You said 40, 40?
40, yeah.
40 years old.
Yeah, roughly. Because it was about 2010 that the ebook landscape really took off, where you were seeing 300-600% year-over-year growth in that industry. I remember, I've been a bookseller for more than 25 years. I remember when Stephen King launched Riding the Bullet, and it was sort of an experiment in ebook selling. But that was, there weren't great readers on the market.
Those were on floppy disks, right?
Yeah, something like that. No, but it was just basically emailed versions of stories or digital. So it was kind of, it wasn't until, obviously the portable readers, the Sony was the first one, the Kindle came out, The iPad was 2010 as well. So thinking about those portable devices, and then obviously Kobo, or then initially known short covers in 2009, became Kobo in 2010 with the free apps on all the on your smartphone. It was around that time, you know, between 2007 and 2010, that a lot of scary things happened. You look at the history of publishing. There were a few significant major changes. Obviously, Gutenberg invented movable type in the printing press, and that, you know, went from scrolls to, you know, the printed expensive hardcover volumes. And then you had the release of the mass market paperback. You know, you think about Pocketbooks and Penguin releasing the mass market paperback, which suddenly made books more, you know, to a larger audience than ever before, particularly people who couldn't afford hardcovers. And then again, it wasn't until 2007 through 2010 that for the, you know, one of the most dramatic changes in publishing, even more dramatic than mass market paperbacks, was this availability. Suddenly ebooks became available, allowed books to be available, even if you didn't have a bookstore in your small town, wherever you happen to be, you could have access instantly and easily to an ebook. And so suddenly there was more opportunity to have access to more books than ever in the history of publishing. And that's really when ebooks started to really take off.
Yeah, my dad was a huge fan of Mr. Anderson here. I did look through his collection. He had tons of your books, especially the Dune stuff. He was a big fan of that. But he passed on in 2008, and my dad would literally consume probably, I would say, two good-sized science fiction books a week. You know, he was just that kind of reader. And these readers would have been great for him because, you know, I don't know that he kept all his books, but I don't know that that was the important part to him. It was the stories and the imagination. And so I think he would have loved a device like this. I think he got to see a little of it, but he didn't get to see what it turned into.
But what was really funny is the, like you said, Mark, 40 years. And you remember from like the 60s and 70s that they were talking for decades about how video phones were going to be in every house, and they just never came, and they never came, and they never came. And then now, finally, with Skype, we actually do video conferences whenever we want to, and we can do that. I guess people weren't thinking that when you call somebody on the phone, you don't want to see if they're in their underwear or if they haven't or whatever. But for ebooks was sort of similar because my first novel was published in 1988, and I followed, you know, publishing, and I was working as an author, and they talked forever about ebooks were going to be the next big thing, and they were going to take over, and I kept waiting, and I kept waiting, and even when I would sign my book contracts, they would started to add things like, and we get the ebook rights, and we would go, yeah, that's like asking for the theme park rights, like anybody wants anything like that. And I remember distinctly my Dune novel, The Butler in Jihad, that I wrote with Brian Herbert, I'm blanking it right at the moment when it is. I think it was 2006-ish. It's right when this was taking off. The publisher called me up one day. The ebook representative, the publisher, was ecstatic because our book, Dune, The Butler in Jihad, was the best-selling ebook in their entire company for 3 months running. And I went, wow, that's great. How many copies did that mean? And he paused and he said, total? 300 copies. And we're like, oh, okay, never mind. And I wasn't really worried about it. And a lot of authors were like me, and we kind of regret it now, because back then, if I had struck the ebook clause from the contract, nobody would have argued. But now we sort of gave it all away because it did take off, and it took a lot of people by surprise.
Well, technology often, you know, evolves in two different ways, right? So it's revolution or evolution, you see a lot of times. And I would say that most of the time, it's evolution. It's very rarely revolution, because you can always kind of find the seeds of whatever it was in something else that – and Apple's the best at this, right? They're the ones that go – everybody thinks, oh, the iPhone or the iPod. Yeah, there were people with, you know, music players before. They waited a while, and then they came out and they said, okay, here's all the mistakes everybody made. Let's make an awesome one. And I think that's, you know, what we saw here in the evolution of this technology was people had tried it. And, yeah, what's interesting to me is, like, my wife – to this day, she wants hardcover books. She does not like the readers. She'd rather have the actual book in her hand. Is that, as an author, are you still finding people that are like that? Or you know, and the same thing for you, Mark, are you finding people like that? Because most of the people I know want to have electronic books, but I imagine there's some people who are outliers.
I just answered this at convention last week when somebody, I was on a panel about ebook publishing and stuff, and there was sort of an old guard fan in the audience said, I just like real books and it's not the real story. And it's the book is the book. It's the paper book. And I don't like these electronic things. And I kind of came up with the best answer for it. I said, so do you like listening to music? He said, yeah. And I said, so which is the real music? The one that's on the album, the one that's on the CD, the one that's on the cassette, the one that's on, an MP3 file.
Right.
It's the music. And the other part is just a delivery system. But I'll punt this back to you, Mark. How, as the consumer goes, how has ebooks like fundamentally changed reading habits?
Oh, well, what we've seen from Kobo is we can not only we can actually see when people are reading, how long they're reading for, you know, the sessions they're reading for, how many page turns, etc. And what we're seeing with our most avid readers is they're actually taking advantage of the fact that they can have 1,000 books on them at all times. Think about that. They're reading more during breaks at work. They're reading more, you know, at lunch break. They're reading more on their commutes. They can pull out their phone, open it up on their app. And what a lot of people are doing is they're doing their app reading while commuting or while in transit, while in the grocery store. And then if they have a device, like a dedicated Kobo reading device, then maybe that's that bedtime book. A lot of people on travel can pack them. Just to give you a high-level stat in terms of in the 10 years between 2002 and 2012, and this is U.S. publishing stats, in 2012, ebook revenue in the U.S. was 0.05%. And in 2012, ebook revenue from all major U.S. publishers was 22.55%. Significant shift in just
that's revolution right there.
That's a major one. And ironically, in the first quarter of 2012, the major publishers made more revenue from ebooks than they did from hardcover, which was a significant stat when you think about that. That's a major change to a very slow moving industry, an industry that's not usually willing to to embrace the future.
So one of the things I know that was a big difference maker for me was as I was moving towards, and I've played with a few of them, but I'm going to go out and get me a Kobo now because I've heard from...
You'll get a Kobo. I recommend it.
I will get a Kobo. It's done. Consider that done. Probably on the way home today. The ability, one of the challenges I have was for technical books, you know, as I was, I do a lot of coding, that sort of thing. I needed to be able to highlight stuff and take notes. And it seemed like the system sort of evolved into that where I was able to do that. And I wonder how many of those little barriers got broken through over that time that created an opportunity. And don't let me forget this. I want to ask what you do with those statistics because I'm fascinated by what those mean and what trends they would look at. This is something I do for a living as I look into financial statistics. I use artificial intelligence. I use big data analytics. So we'll come back to that. But what barriers do you think? Was there any one big one that blew open the door for everybody?
I think it was a portability was probably one of them. But here's the other interesting thing about making notes. You can do it on a Kobo. You can do it on a Kindle as well. You can go into your Kobo, for example, open up a book. You can highlight a passage. You can even leave a note. And you can decide if that note is something you can view, but you can also share it so that other people who download the book after you can have access to see that note.
A reading group as you're reading.
Yeah. So that's something that will be and hasn't yet been because of the way that academic publishing works. But imagine, everyone's studying Shakespearean text or something and they're all using the same reading platform for that class. Imagine everyone in the class being able to share their notes and the professor being able to share their notes with each other. Now, academic publishing is even, further behind a traditional, regular trade publishing, only because they're doing everything they can to lock things down and prevent this digital landscape. They're trying to drive people back to the print book. But there's an opportunity there that we have yet to have discovered. And having been an academic bookseller trying to find ways to save students money, I see amazing opportunities still with that. So, with nonfiction technical reading, You know, I mean, again, you're seeing it in some cases for high-end books that are live books on the web that are being updated on the fly, almost like a Wikipedia, right? Where as technologies change, as the news changes, it can be updated on the fly. We're still at the tipping point when you think about it on just how alive a text can actually be, because we're so used to, you know, putting it on ink on paper and fixing it in place and it's permanent and you have to wait till the next print run. We're barely taking advantage of the possibilities of what publishing can become.
Well, and from a business sense, I want you to talk about things that are like obvious to us, but maybe not obvious to people out there. The major difference between an ebook and a print book is you don't have to pay to print it. You don't have to pay to ship it. You don't have to pay it to store it. You don't have to pay to return it if it doesn't sell. All of the publishing has a very narrow profit margin as it is. And if you remove all of those material costs, it just changes the whole business landscape of publishing, distributing, and bookselling.
Oh, dramatically. And that's where, you know, because I'm the director of self-publishing at Kobo, that's where you see an additional shift in that, because previous to digital, the digital explosion between 2007 and 10, let's say, if you wanted to self-publish, you had to go and get, you could use print-on-demand printing, but it was very difficult because you still had the problem of once you've printed the book to ship it somewhere in the world, and there were costs involved. But suddenly with ebooks, all of those physical, all of that putting a book on a boat or on a truck went away. It was delivered, obviously, through the web. And that barrier cost significantly changed publishing, meaning that for the first time in history, writers could choose to circumvent the gatekeepers in New York publishing. You think of the people who would say, you know, this is a good manuscript, but we just published a novel just like that. Well, that's good for, you know, because the publisher has to bear all the costs and they have a limited amount of investment, so they can only invest so many. But it may not be good for the reader who wants another book like that now, not next year, but now. And that's a significant shift in the demand, the supply and demand. Suddenly, instead of Kevin, I know you're a very prolific writer, so you would only do one book with one publisher per year, which is why you're with six publishers, because you write so much. But suddenly now that you're in digital publishing, you're not limited to a schedule that requires a buyer from Barnes & Noble sitting down with a publisher in New York and deciding what books they're going to buy 6 to 7 to 8 months from now. You know, you could produce books at a schedule that's more in line with what the reader wants to read. They want to read the next book in that series now. They don't want to wait 12 months for that.
I remember the year that it came out, I forget what the second one was, but Stephen King came out with a book called The Eyes of the Dragon, which was his second book of the year. And it was like horrors among the publishers and among the booksellers. Like only Stephen King could pull off publishing two books in 1 year and expect his readers to keep following it. And I know lots of writers now who their goal is a book a month. They want to bring out 10 to 12 books a year. And if they're doing a series, the readers grab the series book, they finish it, and they want the next one now. They don't want to wait a year. Well, they want it now.
Look at the model that James Patterson's put together, which is like this mentorship writing, I guess, that he's doing. And I want to circle back to something you said that blew my mind a minute ago. So you were talking about how we haven't tapped this. And when he said that, it's sort of like got my brain working. So you're saying you're like keeping track of, you know, how often they turn pages and stuff. So let's say Kevin's got this amazing novel and it's in the Kobo and you're looking through it and you're like, hey, Kevin, people are just like struggling through this section right here. Or, you know, in our business world, if we had a form on a website, right, and people were dropping off in a certain place in the form, we would look at that. We would say, okay, like a loan, you know, why are we losing this business? So if someone's on their way through a book, and for whatever reason, they're always putting it down at chapter 10 or something. And you see where I'm going with this? Is
that to add a sex scene at chapter 10.
Right. That's what I'm asking. And I'm saying, can we improve this book on the fly? Is that even a possibility? We think of them as static things.
Yes.
So would, you know, Mark calls you and goes, hey, Kevin, dude, you're killing me in chapter 12. Nobody likes it. Or people love chapter 12. Let's extend it. You know, I mean, is that even like something?
We are doing that, actually. Well, we're doing the feedback and sharing with publishers where people may be stopping, if there's any consistent patterns. We can see how long they sat, how many hours they read, what time of day they're reading, where they're stopping. We've even released, so Kobo has actually released reports, and one of my favorites, because this really supports the high quality of content that's coming through Kobo Writing Life and self-publishing, was the best-selling book from Kobo in the UK was a literary title by Donna Tartt. It was, you know, a major award-winning novel, just well-respected. Everyone who was anyone had a copy of it on their shelves. But what we found was the read-through rate on average on Kobo was, you know, less than 50%, because it was a thick, heavy literary title that, you know, people, they struggled with. You know, obviously, everyone was trying to read it, but they weren't getting through it. The most well-read, I think it was like 86% read-through rate, was a title by a self-published author from the UK. And so we share that kind of data. The one thing preventing us from sharing that data in a very bulk manner with independent authors kind of relates to respecting the privacy of the readers. And I'll give you a perfect example. Kevin J. Anderson sells, you know, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of copies of his books because he's an international best-selling author. So that's not a problem if we share reading data, because it's a big enough base that we know where it is. Myself as an author, I may sell one book to my mom this month. And we actually share with the independent author communities. We basically share the zip code, postal code, et cetera, where your book's sold in the world, because we sell in 190 countries. So if I see that I only sold one book last month, and I call my mom up and my mom says, yeah, I bought your book, I read it, I really liked it. And then I see my reading stats and it says that, you know, the book was never even opened, the ones that I sold, that could cause family feuds. So that's one of the reasons we're not going to release the data. But we are looking at strategic ways by which, if there's enough volume to protect the reader's privacy, how can that aggregate data be used to share with a publisher or an author? Now, interestingly enough, we are sharing that with the major publishers. I don't think they're actually using it, because by the time the book's out, they're already on to the next book. But an independent author, a self-published author, it's their baby, it's their product. If they are getting this, the feedback or statistics that says, you know, everybody seems to stop at chapter 9, they can go back and say, yeah, you know what? My editor suggested I cut this scene in chapter 9. I'm wondering if they were right, because that seems to be the place where everyone stops. So, and again, we're still just at the beginning of being able to tap into that and make changes and say, wow, well, maybe I'll cut that scene. And maybe that'll help people move through.
Did you say that you record where people read it, in the sense of whether I'm at home, in the subway?
We're making assumptions based on time zones and commuting times for the average worker.
Okay.
Right?
So yeah, I was going to say, because I didn't know if the devices had that.
Yeah,
we used to, because the NSA is going to want to use your Kobo device, because I think
we used to have badges you would get for reading during lunch break, or reading during commute, or reading during the witching hour, and that was based on your local time zone. Now, I will tell you something really awesome about one of the latest Kobo device, which is the Kobo Aura 1. You can actually.
Okay, so that's the one I got to get.
It's a very expensive reader, but it is a premier reader for a few reasons. A, it's waterproof. So you can read it in the book, bath, bed, beach, whatever. And it's fine for up to 3 meters deep for an hour. So you're good if you're in a canoe and you're
scuba diving.
Well, I will tell you, I used to go in my pool and scuba dive because I love the peace of it. I used to work at a place. If I could get a book down there, that would be even better.
There you go. Now, the other cool thing about it is, so I was talking about bedtime. It has a built-in light that allow, and again, I'm not a tech guy. I'm the writer content acquisition guy. So it's a basic light that affects your brainwaves in a different way. So it's sort of like a blue-based light that doesn't stimulate your brainwaves. So if I've set on my Kobo Aura 1, if I set that my bedtime is 11, and I happen to be reading close to 11 or after 11, it changes that light on the screen, so that it's calming my brainwaves down, not keeping me awake. Like if I was looking at a computer screen prior to going to bed, that will stimulate my brainwaves and it's harder for you to go to sleep. So what we like to say at Kobo is it should be the book that keeps you awake, not the medium that you're reading it on.
after that, like, you could crank up like some meditative music. And but anyways, Kevin, you were going to make a point just a minute ago about my location of where you're reading.
Well, and I was, you made a comment about the, like, the NSA watching, and you're kind of raising my hackles, Mark, with the somebody's watching how many pages I'm reading. And
I knew that would hit your privacy stuff.
But what about you know? So I've downloaded a copy of the Anarchist's Cookbook, and I keep reading the chapter on. Building a bomb on trains or something. Is NSA going to come? Well, let's not use that example. Let's use a more practical example.
Okay.
What if I'm reading porn, and it tracks? Well, actually,
you and billions of other people, Kevin.
Right. So if that's Kobo, actually has, you've got some kind of standards where you don't allow porn, right? Is there's a,
well, we don't allow illegal, you know, child pornography. Right. We don't allow certain taboo topics into our catalog. Yeah,
but I guess my question is kind of boiling down to the, it sounds a little Big Brotherish if Kobo is getting data for how many pages I turn or which parts that I read, and is that been a concern for any of your customer? I mean, does Kindle do that?
Of course they can. If we can do it, they can do it. iBooks can do it. Everyone can do it. It's there because that's how we support it. So, for example, you read on your Kobo app on your phone, and when you finish reading on the Kobo app, you get to the end of chapter 3 or whatever. And then when you pick up your device, it syncs up between the devices because it knows you finished chapter 3.
So you know where you are. Yeah.
Again, it's all part of that experience. It's even part of bookmarks and leaving notes in the book, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's just the way the technology works. Now, we
and it's only in the EULA too, right?
Yeah, we don't share anything other than the aggregate data to say that the average it took the average user 8 hours to read this book. This other book, which is the exact same word length, was 6 hours. That gives us a read rate, so we can, and we do this because we, you know, Overdrive is our sister company owned by Rakuten. And they power the libraries. Librarians are very interested in finding books that consumers read really, really fast, because the way a bookstore, a bookseller wants to sell more books, a library wants to engage the reader. So they're very fascinated with those concepts.
And I think, Kevin, where you stumbled was when you talked about your mom not reading your book. The reason he said that was correlation, right? So he was able to correlate that because it was such a small amount. I assumed from the beginning that they were anonymizing this information.
Oh, it has to be anonymized.
That's why he was saying you were such a big base.
What I was remembering is the cases where if somebody went into the Barnes & Noble and bought certain books, and then the government tried to subpoena which books they had bought, and they fought it. And it wasn't. So, I mean, we were just talking about previous weapons development and stuff.
Yeah, he's still in his weapons mode.
We're in a different one. But I think what people let me talk about some bad things from the author's point of view as far as the ebook revolution, and it mainly goes back to major traditional publishers in the ebooks, because we always had in our contracts that if a book went out of print and the publisher stopped supporting it, then we, the author, got the rights back, and then we could maybe sell it somewhere else or whatever. And in the transition time, and I'm talking like the mid-90s to the mid-2000s, many of us have contracts that grants them the rights for as long as they keep a book in print. And then it allowed that if you just had an electronic book file up somewhere, that book was considered, quote, in print. So that means that many publishers effectively own a book forever, even if they never sell another copy of it, because they've got the file up somewhere. And a lot of authors kind of resented that for good reason. And there are certain things involved in distribution and how many the royalty statements and the records that are coming out that has just changed things so dramatically from me as an author point of view and from publishers and from booksellers. For instance, in Kobo Writing Life, why don't you tell us about how an author can just watch their sales day by day and location by location. So if they do a radio interview in Calgary, Canada, they can see if their sales went up in Calgary, Canada.
Yeah.
That's never been available to us before.
No, I mean, I get a royalty statement from one of my publishers once a year. And, you know, in May, I find out how many books I sold the previous year, whereas I can log on to Kobo Writing Life and I can see – you know, a book that sold within the last couple hours and what country in the world it sold in. That's revolutionary. The other thing from the writer's perspective, because, you know, we talk about the difference, is when my publisher sells one of my books, I get 8% of that. So a $25 book, I'm getting $2. When I sell a book that's $5.99, I keep 70% of that as the author. So I can sell, you know, five copies or four copies worth the same amount of money and make a significant significant amount more. I think one of the other changes that sort of makes a difference, and I see, I was just talking to Robert J. Sawyer, who's a Canadian science fiction writer, and he has, I know, Kevin, I know you and Rob have been friends for a long, long time. Now, you've known each other, you've grown up in publishing together. But Rob's latest book through Random or Penguin Random House, they only bought the North American rights. And so the book was only available as a print book and an ebook in Canada and the US. Rob used Kobo Writing Life to publish that book internationally. He was able to set, instead of it being a $14 ebook, which is with a publisher's price, and again, he kept a small percentage of that, he was able to set the price at $5, $6, make significantly more per unit sale. And because this book was available in 165 plus countries, where he's established a huge base over the years, he actually outsold them internationally. So again, when you look at the comparison and the flexibility of how digital could allow publishers to navigate the world in a much more efficient way, authors are very often taking advantage of that, because it's not based on print distribution. It's based on a global scale.
So, and that's what, you know, you got me thinking when you were talking there. So in looking at your, you know, the stuff you've done, I noticed you had this novel, I, Death, which was rolled out on a blog, right, as a serialized format.
Yeah.
And it kind of got me thinking about, you know, The Martian, right? So, you know, to me, the Martian was sort of my first exposure to the self-publishing business. You know, I discovered the book and, you know, really, really enjoyed it. Then the movie came out. But as I looked into it, you know, I saw several, you know, he was a lot like you guys. He worked at Sandia Laboratories. But what I found, what was interesting to me was that he switched over to a traditional publisher after it just shot up the charts. Was there, you know, that seems like the opposite of what Kevin's talking about. Was he just like so new to it he didn't get it, or?
Well, no, because, I mean, so Andy Weir, yeah, and he started off the blog. It was actually Podium Publishing, which was an audiobook publisher, that discovered him before Random House did. So, again, small Canadian player in the space did that. But there's economies of scale. So Andy Weir is suddenly like a James Patterson, like a J.K. Rowling. And because, you know, 70 to 80% of book sales in North America are print as opposed to ebooks, and he probably got a huge advance, that was probably an okay deal. But if you're not Andy Weir, if you're not Stephen King, if you're not J.K. Rowling, the economies of scale tip more in your favor, because of the, you're not, it's not the large advance, but it's the actual ongoing royalties that you make more with. So there's this weird, there's still a, you know, a 1% or a 2% rule in terms of that landscape. And it's interesting to see. I honestly believe, and I'm seeing more and more, it's kind of rare when it happens, but just using my own experience, 90% of my own revenue from traditional publishing comes from my print book sales, and maybe 95% of my self-publishing revenue comes from ebook sales. It's why myself, and, you know, we call it being a hybrid author. I know that there are books that I will publish through my publisher in Toronto, Ontario, and they'll get my books into all of the chapters. They'll be getting them into some of the Barnes & Nobles, and they've even gotten my books into Costco and Walmart. I can't do that as an independent author. I can't do that with print distribution. No, but so that's one of the challenges, and that's one of the reasons why authors will continue to work collaboratively with publishers. But then there may be books that are for a specific niche market that may not get that print distribution, but they get, you know, they get immediately, they can have global distribution, books available in 190 countries without shipping books on boats overseas, et cetera.
Well, I'm the same way. I mean, I'm a hybrid. I still publish with my major publishers, but I've got books that are my own books, or they're my backlist books that a major publisher doesn't want to reprint, but my fans still want to read. So I do them myself. I had my series, Dan Shamble's Zombie PI, was with a major publisher here in the U.S., but I only had the sold the U.S. rights to them, so I released the international versions myself, just like Rob Sawyer did. And now, after four books, the other publisher has kind of lost interest and doesn't want to do it, but my fans still want it. I still want to write it, so now I'm publishing the rest of them myself. And I think the key to what you were saying and what John's question was, though, is it depends on what kind of author you are. If you just want to write books and throw them at a publisher and let them do all the work, well, then don't self-publish, because you've got to, I mean, you're the one-man band. You got to do everything, not just writing the book. You got to edit it, and you got to produce the ebooks, and you got to do the social media, and you got to promote it, and you got to do your blogs, you get your mailing list, and use your various promotional items. And it is, I think the term is frickin' exhausting. Every day I look at this and I just go, oh, that's another thing I'm not doing. And that's another thing I'm not doing. And I'm just now, there's a new software developed for the Apple for indie authors that's called Vellum. And I'm just like, well, I need to know this. And I've spent, you know, a couple of days learning how to do that and laying in. And, you know, I don't have time to learn new software. I don't have time to do all this stuff. But I don't have time to do a podcast either. And I guess
and here we are.
Everything. So I also want to focus on what you just said about the international to really hammer home, because I've published, well, they have my credits, 140 books, and a lot of them are media tie-in and Star Wars books, which I don't have the rights to, but my own books, it was, for us American authors, and again, nobody's going to sympathize with me complaining here, but American authors are published in America, but trying to sell the Bulgarian rights to your book, it just never happens. And, or the Italian rights or the French rights. Or, I mean, only a very small percentage of U.S. books get translated to overseas markets.
And when you say translated, you mean language translation.
Language
right.
Translated. Okay. But see, that's the thing. And Mark and I have talked about this. What the really cool thing is in so many markets around the world, they read English.
Yeah.
And the only way that they could get my first novel, Resurrection Inc., that I published, it wasn't translated into any other languages. I've got a lot of fans all around the world who would like to read that book, but if they were in, say, India, the only way they could get that book was if they paid like $100 and got some specialty bookstore to get a hard copy mailed to Mumbai or something mm-hmm. like that. But when I go on Kobo and I select worldwide distribution, anybody with a smartphone in Pakistan can download my book for $5 or well, you change the prices in different markets, and for India, Pakistan, you make it fairly cheap. But all of my library, which nobody in these other countries could ever read, is suddenly available, provided they can read English.
But I'm going to take you back to what Mark said earlier, and so let's change your world, right? So we live in a world now. Just recently, there was this cool experiment. So there's a product called TensorFlow. It's not really a product; it's a platform by Google. Mark, are you aware of TensorFlow? Do you know?
No,
what that
not
is?
Actually.
So TensorFlow is Google's AI product. It's an artificial intelligence product. So have you ever used Google Translate?
Yes.
Yeah.
So Google Translate was interesting. For a long time, Google Translate worked like this. Let's say that you wanted to translate German to English, right? So that was no problem. That was a direct translation. Pretty much anything to English was a direct translation. But let's say you wanted to do Korean to Japanese. Okay, that's a little different. Well, the engine in the background for a long time, because it wasn't an artificial intelligence or a machine learning engine, would translate it to English first and then translate it to Japanese. What could possibly go wrong? But so what they did was they built this artificial intelligence engine. They taught it Japanese. They taught it Korean. And they taught it, you know, English and the whole nine yards. And they put it out there. And what interesting thing happened? The AI developed its own language for in between all the other languages on its own without being told. So where I'm going with this, and it was interesting because
and it wasn't Esperanto.
Yeah. Where it ended up is, so I just got back from an international speaking gig in Vienna, and I'm sure you've spoken internationally. Have you ever had it where the translators are they got it on? You ever tell a joke and watch it land like for half the audience, but like watch the other half go, wow, the translator, like some of them are looking at you like you just said something horrible about their mom, you know? So, but what if through this artificial intelligence, you know, we could cram this in the Kobos, and with a 98%, you know, accuracy, this thing could translate to Italian on the fly. it could translate it to, you know, to the, you know, to whatever version of
the universal translator, right, with your e-reader.
Right. And so it seems, but that to me is technology that exists now. I mean, what's keeping you from doing that, Mark? I guess
you know what I think, because we've done a lot in different languages and translations. The process isn't just translating, but you actually rewrite the book in that language. There are ways. Yeah. There are turns of phrase that just don't work if it were a pure translation. So the AI would have to be very sophisticated enough to be creative, I think.
Oh, and I get your point from a culture standpoint. That's exactly what I was thinking. And what I'm telling you is, it's there. That kind of, yeah. If we're, but the other things I know I'm doing on the other side of my world with AI, I promise you, it's not that far off that we couldn't say, okay, let's experiment. I say we do it tonight. Well, which one do we want to translate? But I want to come back to one other question just real quick. So this serialized, I'm back on this serialized novella as a blog, right? And you're writing something like that too on your website, Wordfire.
Yeah, I had my new novel that I was writing. I had people could subscribe, and I would upload the chapters every day.
I'm subscribed. Yeah, I subscribed back when I first met you. And so how is that process? You know, like when I read about the Martian guy, the thing that was interesting to me was that he was putting these things out there, and then all of a sudden dudes from the JPL showed up, and they're going, hey, you know, that's wrong. You're crazy. And so he goes back and adjusts that chapter, and finally they go, this is good. And then he moves on. You know, is that kind of the new way of writing to some extent where, you know, you're crowdsourcing this writing through these novellas and the blog and getting feedback from the comments?
It's good and it's bad, because if you are a consumer, if you're the reader, you might not want to watch the sausage being made. You might want to actually get the finished product and read it and enjoy it. But the freedom that it gives me as the authors, if I got a fan that calls up and just says, you idiot, the lift on your airplane wing was wrong. You got to change it to this. And I go, well, okay, I can change it. I could never change it before. But think about the poor book collectors that are trying to get their first editions. There's no such thing as a first edition. Even my major publishers now, it used to be when your book went back for a second printing or a third printing, that was a big deal because a printing was like 10,000 copies. But now they got technology so that if you go back for printing, we went back for printing 500 more copies. And which is good because warehousing costs are smaller. The print costs are smaller. It's catering directly to the market rather than like overblowing and printing 300,000 copies and hope that you sell half of them. I mean, that's it's a good thing.
On the flip side, Kevin, I do want to talk about, because when I did iDeath, when I wrote iDeath, all I knew was a basic premise, and because I'm a pantser, I knew some basic characters. Shame. And I knew
What's that called?
Flying by the seat of your pants, a pantser.
Oh, pantser. That's good. I want to go with that.
I knew roughly how I wanted it to end. And over the course of 9 months, I rolled this story out with people following it along live. And I was able to modify and change the story based on the things that they liked and the things they didn't like. So if they it was kind of like doing an improv where, oh, the audience is really reacting to this joke or this kind of joke, I'm going to do more of this kind of joke. And that really shifted the way that the book worked. Now, that in and of itself was an amazing experience. I even had them decide how a particular character was going to end up being a hero or a villain, because I was writing him in a way that he could go either way, and they basically answered that for me. And then the last thing was, I ended up actually selling that to a publisher afterwards after going through this whole experience. So I mean it was in 2006 that I did this. An amazing experience that I absolutely adored, and I look forward to doing more, because you've never been able to do that before, except when you're telling a live story in front of people and around a campfire.
So why can't I do that in Kobo?
So Kobo is basically more like a traditional bookstore, right? You buy the book that is already complete. If you're looking for an experience like that, you do have blogs. Wattpad, W-A-T-T.
What's that?
Wattpad.com allows
you... That's a blog, right?
Yeah, well, that allows you to subscribe or follow a book that's being published chapter by chapter, very much the way a podcast might be released.
But what if I want to read it in my cool Kobo on the plane?
Well, I guess you can. Now, we are experimenting with that. We have done that in the past. We worked collaboratively with Random House Canada a couple years ago to release a Kelly Armstrong novel instead of the full book, which was available at the very end. You could actually read it week by week. Now, that again, that's still emerging technology. There are indie authors who are doing, they call them episodes. So every week they release a new episode that's 10 or 20,000 words. And over the course of the summer, the full novel is completed. But that's, again, that's still using the technology as if it were a bookstore rather than an actual automatic subscription service like you get with, you know, your subscription to this podcast, for example.
And we may actually have Ashley from Wattpad on as a guest at some point, because it's an interesting and actually to me a scary prospect. It's basically this giant library of people putting up their own works in progress, and everybody reads them and they exchange information, and they get, I heard her, it's like billions of pages read that they have on it. It's pretty amazing. But so there's that kind of a interactive workshop experience. I wanted to tell one kind of amusing example about e-readers and how you can carry bunches of stuff with them. That a few years ago, my wife and I took a Mediterranean cruise. So we got on the plane in Denver and we flew to Rome. And now we're going to be gone for a week. So I had my, so I think it was my first generation Kindle that I had. And I thought, this is great. I'm going to be gone a week. I'd put like 5 or 6 books I wanted to read on my Kindle, and I put it in my computer case. And I was going to, you know, on a cruise ship, I was going to read a whole bunch. And we landed in Rome, and I opened up my computer case, which had been up in the overhead bin, and I pulled out the Kindle and had a giant crack along the screen. And,
all because of that.
And I couldn't read anything. So I lost all of the books that I brought along because my Kindle had broken.
Eggs in one basket.
And your paperback books don't break. So that is one of the...
Arguably, that overhead bin would be a lot more full.
That's true. Although, Kevin, I mean, because the books are actually not just on the reader, they're in the cloud, you probably could have opened your app on your phone.
At the time, there was no cloud in there.
So let me tell you what I did with the first Kindle. So the first Kindle came out, and I was working at a large credit union in California, and we had a board, and the board was pretty distributed across the whole California area. So we had people as far as San Diego. And if you've been in California, it doesn't even matter if you're only 10 miles away, because it could still be a 2-hour ride. And we would have board meetings. And I thought, you know, it sure would be nice to stop killing all this paper and sending all these binders. And this thing had something called WhisperNet at the time. And I could send a PDF. It would make an email address. And I could send a PDF to it, and then the PDF would show up on the e-reader. And so I checked into it. We didn't really have anything that was – I was worried about security-wise. It was more just, you know, reports and information about being on the board. So we started using it for that, and, you know, they loved it because they liked being able to have it, not worry about carrying all this paper back and forth to the board. After a while, the notes came out, and they started doing what you were talking about, which was, you know, sharing some notes back and forth. Is that a use case that you see a lot of now as people starting to take in these e-readers and using them for this group read kind of mentality?
Yeah, so two things. I mean, the latest Kobo device I was telling you about has a built-in OverDrive app. So, again, our mandate is read more. We want people to read more, and we want to remove the barrier for reading. So they can actually, on the device, you can basically just check out a book from your local library on the device. Because again, we believe that if people read more, that makes the world better for publishers and authors, because that more reading begets more reading. But the other thing is the people in the industry are actually using their iPads and also using their Kobos and their Kindles to actually read the manuscripts, right? So, you know, when Kevin submits the book to his agent or to a publisher or whatever, they may be reading that version on their device, so that they don't have to cart, a truckload of manuscripts around with them on the subway on their way into New York. They can actually read them on the subway on the way in.
And book reviewers much prefer e-galleys now instead of like printed paper review copies that they go, they get 100 a day. They don't want to have them all sitting there. Then what do they do with them? They want them all just files. They pick the one that they want to read. One of the things I was remembering from when I was a kid, that we had some of the local neighbor ladies were big romance readers, like the Harlequin readers.
Oh, yeah. Readers. My grandmother. Oh, my goodness.
Anybody you know who's like a real Harlequin reader, they go through a grocery bag full of those books a week.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember this lady used to, every week, she would bring a grocery bag of the paperbacks she had read that week and would donate them to the library. And what I think ebooks has done is taken over that market, the people that read in massive quantities, that just, they're not collectors. They don't have a library big enough to hold all this stuff. They just want to read and go on to the next one. And
yeah, they're just consuming the story.
Like your dad.
We love those. Those are our favorite customers. Those are our best customers. We actually call them silver foxes based on the demographics of the people and just how much they read. An average of 3 books a day, for example.
Wow.
Well, but one of the flip sides of that, though, has the ebooks, the Kindles, the Kobos, and everything, all of those sales, the 30% of books sold in America or whatever our percentage is, that has really affected our traditional mass market paperback market, though, right? Hasn't that the ones that people would go into the grocery store and just walk away with an armload of books, they now getting a paperback book, the sales on paperback books have pretty much dropped. That's kind of like the middle class vanishing as the mass market class is vanishing because the people who would buy a paperback book are not like the ones that want to keep it in their library forever. They want to grab something to read when they get on the airplane.
Yeah.
So why carry a physical brick around with you when you can just load it onto your ebook? So that has been an unintended consequence of ebooks, but it's not necessarily a bad one.
No, because what we did find when we did some studies here in Canada is we looked at, ironically, folks who read ebooks read 3 times as many books as they used to when they read print. So that's a good thing. But ironically, they bought, it was like 10% more books than they used to when they were only buying print. 10% more print books that they used to when they were only reading print books. And the reason that happens is you may read a book in ebook format and you've enjoyed it so much that you either buy a copy to have because you get a chance to get it signed by the author, or, and this is common because the, you know, 70% of the industry is still reading print, I read this great new Dan Shamble book by Kevin J. Anderson, and I want to give it to my friend, but my friend doesn't read ebooks, so I go and buy a mass market paperback version and I give him that. Yeah, exactly.
I just did that recently with a book.
I'm even worse. When I started reading on my e-reader, and we have a big library in our house, I started reading on my e-reader, and I'd finish a book, and I'd go, well, it doesn't count unless I have the trophy I can put on my shelf. So I would actually go out and finish reading the e-book because it was more convenient when I'm traveling, and then I'd buy the physical book to stick it on my shelf so that I could put it next to my other Robin Hobb books or whatever. So I stopped doing that.
I can remember doing the same thing with movies. You know, if I rented a movie and I liked it a lot, I'd go out and get it on Blu-ray,
exactly.
Knowing that every bit of data I would ever get, every format I get will be obsolete.
And we just had a garage sale at our house, so we got rid of tons of paperback books.
I bet.
And CDs and Blu-rays and everything. But it's just that this is our world, and it is
changing
dramatically. And part of me is still a little bit stunned because, like I said, my first book was published in 1988. My first New York Times bestseller was 1992 or 1993. I had 50 some bestsellers, 140 books published. And all of a sudden, the last 5 years, my entire industry that's been around since Gutenberg has suddenly like fallen out from under my feet. And I'm scrambling and changing and learning, and we're going to have Dean Wesley Smith on as a guest, who's a very active indie publisher. He owns his own publishing company, and he'll talk all about the huge changes and advantages for authors. But for me, I know a lot of my peers who have just thrown in the towel and gone to get day jobs at Home Depot, and I'm not. I'm a survivor, and I'm just trying every
possible
thing.
You seem to be surviving pretty well, so.
But Mark has been one of my mentors, even just showing me tons and tons of stuff. And this is a we'll kind of wrap up with this, Mark. It's a huge community of us indie authors who are all in the same boat, sharing information, helping each other out. And you yourself have been a major crusader in untold numbers of writers conferences, and including our Superstars Writing Conference here that I run. But you've helped create a real community, and there are other podcasts, and it's like a tribe of people who want to share. And Mark, I appreciate all that you're doing. Do you want to tell us how we can find you, or tell us?
Well, hang on, I got a quick question, Mike. Really important. This is important because
right.
I'm worried. Okay, so Mark, if you find one of these, what'd you call them, silver foxes, and they're spending more than, say, 12 hours a day reading, according to your statistics, do you call, like, 911 or something? Because, like, at some point, you know, that seems I think you've got a duty to humanity to do that sort of thing. Anyways, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, that's funny. No, you're saying, hey, these are good people. They're reading a lot. And we
No, they keel over with a –
Oh, keeled over, I see.
Do you add a defibrillator to
their – Then they'll see that the pages have stopped.
That's right. Yeah. They just really like this one passage. No, I think the joy of this new publishing industry is just how not only are writers and readers able to connect in really, really good ways, but the community of writers is so supportive and so wonderfully willing to share. And I am enthusiastic that that sharing and that collaboration is going to help us take writing and publishing opportunities to an entirely new, amazing level.
And Mark, how do we find out about Kobo and KWL?
So you can go to KoboWritingLife.com, where you can see book articles about the craft and business of writing. We have a podcast there. You can follow us at Kobo Writing Life on the various platforms. And myself, I'm at Mark Leslie on Twitter, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, you also have a website. It looks like markleslie.ca.
That's right.
All right.
And we'll have all the links on our podcasting. And Mark is one of our instructors this coming February at the Superstars Writing Seminar.
I noticed that. I saw that on the website.
Because we can't get rid of him, he keeps coming back.
He just can't get rid of me like a cheap.
He's like one of those novella blogs. Yeah. He just, you know, every week.
He's there. Anyway, well, thanks for your time, Mark, and for your insights. And that wraps up our next podcast of Creative Futurism.
Yep. Thanks, everyone. You can find me, John Best, at creativefuturism.com. That's where our blog is. That's where all these podcasts will be. That's where all the show notes will be. And if you got comments, if you hated this, please go on there and say you hated it. If you loved it, that's good, too.
Write to John directly.
Yeah, yeah. If you hated it, I'll give you the email for that. But, you know, come check us out and go buy a Kobo, I guess, is what I'm going to say.
I recommend it. Thanks, everybody.
You've been listening to Creative Futurism with Kevin J. Anderson and John Best. For more information, visit us at creativefuturism.com.